Hi, this is Tolga Karayla. I have prepared some lecture notes for vector functions of one variable and arc length and line integrals of functions. Let's go over those lecture notes together. The first section that we are going to consider is the vector functions of one variable, which is section 11.1 from the textbook. As the name suggests, a vector function of one variable is a function whose values are vectors and whose domain is a subset of one-dimensional space real numbers. So we can define such a vector function, let's call it R, as follows. A vector function in three-dimensional space R3, defined as R of t, can be given by giving the components of the vector as functions of t. So R of t is written as the vector whose components are x of t, comma y of t, comma z of t, where t ranges from a to b. Actually, let me define the function like this. We mean that the domain of that function is the closed interval ab in real numbers. But indeed, the domain of a vector function does not have to be an interval. It could be any subset of real numbers. And instead of using the notation x of t, comma y of t, comma z of t, we can also denote the value of the function r of t as x of t times the vector I plus y of t times the vector j plus z of t times the vector k, where I, j, k are the basis vectors in the standard basis for three-dimensional space. In other words, as you may remember, I is the vector 1, 0, 0, j is the vector 0, 1, 0, and k is the vector 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. And instead of defining a vector function in three-dimensional space, we could also define a vector-valued function in two-dimensional space. In that case, that vector function will have two component functions, which are just x of t and y of t. And one interpretation of a vector function is the following. So we may consider r of t as the position of a moving point at time t. And that point could be moving in R2 or in R3. Depending on this, we are going to have either two or three components of the vector valued function. And remember also that when we have a point P, we can consider the point P as a vector P, where this vector is just the vector from origin O to the point P itself. So the components of the vector are the same as the coordinates of the point. By this identification of points as vectors from origin to that point, the position of a moving point in space could be considered as a vector. That's why we can call it r of t as the vector, which gives us the position of the moving point. Now, after giving those definitions, in the next page we can see two graphs. So when you have a vector function, when you plot the points which are written as r of t for some t in the domain of that vector function, when you plot all of such points, what you obtain will be a curve in either the two or the three dimensional space, and every point on that curve will be a point which can be expressed as r of t for some t in the domain of that vector function. If we consider the limits and continuity concepts for vector functions, let's first take a vector function in a three-dimensional space. R of t equals x of t, comma y of t, comma z of t, such that t is in the domain D of that vector-valued function. If we want to consider the limit as t approaches t0 of that R of t, which means the limit of the vector x of t, y of t, z of t, as t approaches t0, we calculate this by taking the limits of each component. So we look at the vector whose components are the limit of x of t, comma, the limit of y of t, comma, the limit of z of t, as t approaches t0. But of course, this will be the result of the limit if all of these three limits exist. So even if one of the limits of the component functions, the limit of x or limit of y or limit of z does not exist, then we are going to say that the limit of r of t does not exist. And as you remember, for a function to be continuous, when we talked about functions of one variable, we said that the limit of the function exists and it equals the value of the function. So this is the same concept for a vector function of one variable. If the limit of r of t as t approaches t0 exists and it equals the value of the function r of t at t0, which means the limit of r of t as t approaches t0 equals r of t0, then r of t is called continuous at t equals t0. So to summarize, when we take limits of vector functions, we calculate the limits component-wise, and actually r of t will be continuous if all the component functions x of t, y of t, and z of t are continuous functions. After limits and continuity, let's now consider the derivatives of vector functions of one variable. So the derivative of a function of one variable, f of x, was defined as the limit of the difference quotient. We apply the same idea here to define the derivative of a vector function. Let's take again r of t equals x of t, y of t, z of t as a vector function in a three-dimensional space. Then the derivative r prime at t0, which is denoted as d by dt of r of t at t equals t0, is defined as the limit as h goes to 0 of r of t0 plus h minus r of t0 divided by h. So we subtract the value of the function r at t equals t0 from the value of the function r at t0 plus h and divide this by the change in the variable t, which is h here, because t changes from t0 to t0 plus h. In short, we are actually taking the limit of the difference quotient as delta t approaches 0 here. And when we write down r of t0 plus h and r of t0 as vectors using the component functions, at the end, this limit corresponds to taking the limits of difference quotients of x of t, y of t, and z of t separately. And at the end, what we obtain is a vector whose components are x prime t0, y prime t0, and z prime t0 if all of these three derivatives exist at t equals t0. As a result, for r of t as a vector function, r prime t, the derivative of r of t, is nothing but the vector function whose components are x prime t, y prime t, and z prime t. In other words, to differentiate, to find the derivative of a vector function, we calculate the derivatives of the component functions separately. The interpretation of finding the derivative r prime t can be explained as follows. So if we consider r of t as the position of a moving point at time t, then the derivative r prime t, which we can denote by v of t, actually corresponds to the velocity of that moving point at time t. And if we take the second derivative of r, which is r double prime t, which will mean the derivative of r prime t, in other words, v prime t, that is the derivative of the velocity vector, we are going to find the acceleration of that moving point, which can be written as the vector function a of t. And from the r prime t vector function, if I take the length of that r prime t vector function, which is the length of the vector x prime t, comma y prime t, comma z prime t, this is the square root of x prime t squared plus y prime t squared plus z prime t squared. What we obtain at the end is just a function of one variable. It's not a vector function, it's just a scalar function, and the length of the velocity is actually the speed of that moving point. It just gives the magnitude of the length of the velocity vector, not the direction. It's just a scalar function now. In the above discussion, we have considered vector functions in three dimensions, but if we consider vector functions in R2, we are going to only have two components, x of t and y of t, and the limits, continuity, the derivatives, which are all calculated component-wise, can be similarly calculated by just looking at the two components, x of t and y of t, just ignoring the third component in the above formulas. Okay, after that brief information about the derivatives, let's now consider integrals of vector functions. Again, I'm going to explain it using vector functions in three dimensions, but as before, if we consider a vector function in two dimensions, just ignore the third components and the formulas you have will be valid in two-dimensional space too. Okay, now let's again consider R of t as x of t, y of t, z of t, and the indefinite integral of R of t dt will mean a vector function f of t plus a vector v, where that capital F of t is an antiderivative of the vector function R of t. In other words, f prime t is R of t, and here in that notation, v is an arbitrary constant vector. So in the indefinite integral of a function of one variable, we had an antiderivative plus an arbitrary constant. But now, for indefinite integral of a vector function, the arbitrary constant will be a constant vector, not a constant number. So when we say f of t plus v, that arbitrary constant v at the end is also a vector. By an antiderivative, capital F of t for R of t, we mean a vector function whose derivative f prime is equal to R of t. So if the antiderivative capital F has component functions P of t, Q of t, R of t, then the equality f prime t equals R of t will just mean that P prime t, comma Q prime t, comma R prime t as a vector will be the same as R of t, which is x of t, comma y of t, comma z of t. In other words, p prime is x of t, q prime t is y of t, and r prime t is z of t. So the components of the antiderivative f, which are p, q, and r, are actually antiderivatives of x of t, y of t, and z of t functions. So this tells us that to calculate the indefinite integral of r of t dt, which is the indefinite integral of x of t, comma y of t, comma z of t dt, it is enough to calculate the vector whose components are indefinite integrals of x of t, y of t, and z of t. So we actually calculate the indefinite integrals again component-wise, and this will give us the vector whose components are p of t plus c1, comma q of t plus c2, comma r of t plus c3, where these c1, c2, c3 here are arbitrary constant numbers. But this can be written as p of t, comma q of t, comma r of t as a vector plus the vector c1, c2, c3. And this calculation shows you how the arbitrary constant vector v at the end arises from the indefinite integrals of components separately. So the indefinite integral of a vector function is actually a family of vector functions, which all differ by a constant vector. Now, when we come to the definite integrals of vector functions, the definite integral from a to b of r of t dt is again the integral from a to b of the vector function x of t, y of t, z of t, dt at the end, and the result is a vector whose components are just the definite integrals of x of t, y of t, and z of t. Again, the result of the definite integral of a vector function is calculated by integrating the component functions separately as a definite integral from A to B. And at the end, what this corresponds to is just capital F of B minus capital F of A, where capital F is an antiderivative of R of T. So this is the version of fundamental theorem of calculus for vector functions, actually. Because here we say that the definite integral of R of T from A to B is just the difference of values of an antiderivative capital F at the points t equals b and t equals a. So we can rephrase this as saying that the net change in the values of capital F as a vector function, which is f of b minus f of a, the net change in values of f on the interval from a to b, this is the same as the definite integral from a to b of the derivative of f. Or we could say that the definite integral of a vector function gives us the net change in an antiderivative of that vector function. As a simple example, which is quite familiar from your physics course, could be the following. So when you consider the net change in the position, which will give you the displacement on a time interval from A to B, let's say, R of B minus R of A, which will be the displacement, will be the same as the integral from A to B of the velocity function V of t dt, where your V of t is actually R prime t dt. Now, let's consider a vector function, and the image of a vector function defined on an interval is actually called a curve. So a curve C is actually the image of a vector function R of t defined on an interval. So the curve C consists of points of the form x, y, z, such that x, y, z can be written as R of t for some t in the domain of the vector function R. And in that case, the curve C is said to be parametrized by that vector function R of t. So R of t is a parametrization of the curve C, which is the image of R of t. Considering a vector-valued function R of t as the position of a moving point at time t, the curve C is nothing but the path of that motion, and C consists of all points through which the moving point passes during that motion. And for a parametrization R of t on an interval from A to B, R of A is called the initial point of that curve C, and R of B is called the terminal point of the curve C. When the component functions of a parametrization are continuous, that vector function R of t is called a continuous parametrization. And for such a continuous parametrization, the curve C parametrized by that R of t has no breaks. Actually, that curve C will be a connected curve. As a simple example of a curve parametrized by a vector function, let's consider R of t equals t comma t squared, where t can be any real number. And actually, this vector function will parametrize the parabola y equals x squared. Now, when you consider the points in the image of that parametrization, x comma y will be t comma t squared, which means that x is t and y is t squared. And we see that in that case, x squared will be t squared, which is y. So y will be equal to x squared. This tells us that all points in the image lie on the parabola y equals x squared. But is the image all of the parabola? To answer this, if we take a point on the parabola, Now that point x comma y will be written in the form x comma x squared, because y is x squared on the parabola, which means that x comma y, which is x comma x squared, is actually r of x. It is in the image of the parametrization. That's why this parametrization parametrizes all of the parabola y equals x squared. Now if we move on to the next page, we have the example 2, which shows us that the same curve can be parametrized in several different ways. Actually, we are given two different parametrizations of the upper same circle here. The first parametrization is given by R1 of t equals xy equals cosine t comma sine t, where t changes from 0 to pi. Actually, when x is cosine t and y is sine t, x squared plus y squared will be 1. So such points will be on the circle x squared plus y squared equals 1. But since t changes from 0 to 1, when t is 0, we are at the point 1 on the x-axis. And as t increases from 0 to pi over 2, we move on the first quarter of the circle and arrive at the point 1 on the y-axis. And when t becomes pi, we'll be at the point minus 1 on the x-axis. So as t goes from 0 to pi, the point will move on the circle x squared plus y squared equals 1, but it will trace only the upper semicircle. That's why this parametrization parametrizes the upper semicircle, starting from the point on the right, which is 1 on the x-axis, and going towards the left on the semicircle and stopping at the point minus 1. And another parametrization of the upper semicircle is given by R2 of x. R2 of x is given as x comma square root of 1 minus x squared. So when we sketch the upper semicircle, which is on the circle x squared plus y squared equals 1, the upper part will have a positive y, so y will be the square root of 1 minus x squared there. As a result, points on the upper semicircle have coordinates x comma square root of 1 minus x squared. That's why this parametrization, when x changes from minus 1 to 1, will parametrize all of the upper semicircle. But this time the direction is from left to right. In R1, the direction was from right to left. Now it is from left to right. So the same curve, the upper semicircle, is parametrized by two different parametrizations, but here the directions of the parametrizations are different. Indeed, every curve can be parametrized in infinitely many different ways. And now if you look at example 3, we are looking at an example of a parametrization in three-dimensional space. So if the parametrization is r of t equals 1 plus t, comma 1 plus 2t, comma 1 plus 3t, where t is between 1 and 2, actually this should be familiar from the vector equations of lines. So if we had t taking all values in R, what we had would be just the vector equation of a line, of the line which passes through the point 1, 1, 1, and which has direction vector 1, 2, 3. But since here t changes from 1 to 2, this parametrization will parametrize the curve, which is the part of that line between R of 1 and R of 2. Here R of 1 is the point 2, 3, 4, and R of 2 is the point 3, 5, 7. So actually, the given parametrization just parametrizes the line segment between the two points 2, 3, 4, and 3, 5, 7 on that line. There's one more example of parametrizations. Let's consider the fourth example, which is the helix. The given parametrization here is r of t equals cosine t comma sine t comma t as t is greater than or equal to 0. So in that parameterization, t starts at 0 and takes all positive values. Now, to understand the shape of the curve parameterized by that vector function, we can consider the projection of that curve to xy plane. Note that the projection of a point xyz to xy plane is the point x, y, 0, and this could be considered as the point x, y on the xy plane. So when we project r of t, which is cosine t, sine t, t to xy plane, we get cosine t, sine t. And this gives us the parameterization of the projection of the curve C to xy plane. If we call that projection curve C2, its parameterization is cosine t, sine t, where t is greater than or equal to 0. But this is exactly the unit circle, because when x is cosine t and y is sine t, then x squared plus y squared will be 1. And as t takes all values from 0 to infinity, the moving point on that circle will go around the circle infinite many times. In short, the projection to xy plane, which is the curve C2, is just the unit circle. And at time t, when the projection is on the point cosine t, sine t, the z-coordinate of the point on the curve C parameterized by the given original parameterization will be t. So as the projection is the point cosine t, sine t, the z-coordinate will be t, and as t takes values from 0 to infinity, that z-coordinate will keep increasing as the projection moves around the circle C2 in the counterclockwise direction. As a result, the curve C is just a helix which winds up the cylinder x squared plus y squared equals 1 in R3, as shown in the figure. Note that when we write down xyz is equal to cosine t, sine t, t, which means x is cosine t, y is sine t, and z is t, we see that x squared plus y squared, which is cosine squared t plus sine squared t, will be 1. So we observe that any point xyz on the curve C satisfies the equation x squared plus y squared equals 1. Now the graph of x squared plus y squared equals 1 in R3 is a cylinder, and this tells us that the curve C lies on the cylinder, because any point xyz on the curve C satisfies the equation of the cylinder. Now, if we talk about smooth parameterizations and smooth curves, if we have a parameterization R of t, where t changes between A and B of a curve C, we call such a parameterization R of t a smooth parameterization if the derivative R prime t is continuous as a vector function on the open interval AB, and R prime t is not equal to zero vector for any t. Using the interpretation of R of t as the position of a moving point on the curve C at time t, for the parameterization to be a smooth parameterization, it just means that the velocity vector v of t, which is r prime t, changes continuously, and the velocity never becomes zero. In other words, the moving point on the curve C never stops. And a curve C is called a smooth curve if it has a smooth parameterization. Don't forget that a curve C can be parameterized in various different ways, and it is enough that one of those parameterizations to be smooth, so that C is called a smooth curve. And a curve C is called a piecewise smooth curve if, first of all, C is a continuous curve, and secondly, it's a union of finitely many continuous curves. So in the pictures, in the graphs drawn here, we see some examples of smooth curves and piecewise smooth curves. In the piecewise smooth curves, the curve consists of several finitely many pieces, such that each piece is a smooth curve. So each piece has a smooth parameterization. And actually, in those examples, the corners or the sharp edges on the curves are points where there's a sudden change in the direction of the curve. So we cannot have a continuous velocity function for a point moving on such curves unless the point stops at those corners or cusps. That's why those piecewise smooth curves sketched here cannot have a smooth parametrization. As an example, if we consider the parametrization r of t equals t cubed comma t squared, t in r as a parametrization of a curve in two-dimensional space, when we look at the derivative r prime t, we see that it is given as the vector function 3t squared comma 2t, and the component functions x of t equals 3t squared and y of t equals 2t, they are both continuous. But now, when t is 0, that r prime vector, r prime 0, is the 0 vector. Although r prime t is a continuous vector function, it becomes the 0 vector at a point when t becomes 0. And when we sketch the parametrized curve, actually, we can easily see that the parametrized curve is nothing but the curve given by the equation y is equal to x to power 2 over 3. In the graph, we see that there is a cusp at the origin, and this is a point where the curve is singular, which means that there is no tangent line to the curve passing through the origin. That's why this parametrization here is not a smooth parametrization, because although r prime t is continuous, it becomes zero at a point, and the parametrized curve is not a smooth curve because it has a singular point, and it can never have a smooth parametrization as a result of this. Okay, now if we move on to the next page, for C, a curve given by a parametrization r of t, if you know that r prime at a point t0 is not the zero vector, then we can talk about the tangent line to the curve C at the point r of t0. So the point P equals r of t0 is a point on the curve, and the derivative r prime t0 will be a direction vector for the tangent line to the curve passing through that point P. And a vector equation of that tangent line can be written as L is described by xyz equals r of t0 plus t times r prime t0, where t is in r, real numbers. Here, the tangent line passes through the point P given by r of t0, and a direction vector for the tangent line is the velocity vector, or the derivative vector, r prime at t0. When we have a curve with a smooth parametrization, that smooth parametrization will determine a direction on the curve C from the initial point to the terminal point. And if you want to know the direction on that curve determined by that parametrization, at the point r of t0, we can just calculate r prime t0, which is v of t0. This is the velocity vector, or we can call it the tangent vector to the curve C at that point. That vector will show the direction of the curve determined by that parametrization. We can also define a closed curve as a curve which has a parametrization such that the initial and the terminal points are equal to each other. So in the sketch diagrams here, we see some examples of closed curves. And when there is no crossing, when there is no self-crossing of the curve, we can call such a closed curve a simple closed curve. Otherwise, if there are self-crossings, such closed curves will not be simple. And for a simple closed curve, we can have one of the two directions, which are called the clockwise direction or the counterclockwise direction. And such clockwise and counterclockwise directions are also shown on the two examples on the bottom of this page. Now, if we come to some techniques of parametrizing certain types of curves, let's begin by some simple types of curves whose parametrizations are easy to produce. The first one will be the graph of a function y equals f of x defined on a closed interval ab. So this will be a curve in two-dimensional space, the graph of a function f of x, which is the graph of the equation y equals f of x on the interval ab, is a curve in two-dimensional space. And if we consider a point on that curve, if the x-coordinate is x0, then the y-coordinate will be f of x0. So every point on that graph can be written in the form xy equals x, f of x, such that x is between a and b. And this gives us the parametrization of that graph. And the direction here will be from left to right, as x ranges from a to b. The second type of curves whose parametrizations can be formulated easily are circles in two dimensions again. So for a circle of radius capital R and center origin, its equation is x squared plus y squared equals capital R squared. Take a point on the circle and join it to the origin, and then consider the angle between the positive x direction and that ray as an angle, and call that angle t. Then the coordinates of the point xy on the circle are simply given by r times cosine t, comma r times sine t. And as t ranges from 0 to 2 pi, this way you will get all points on the circle. That's why this circle C is parametrized by r of t equals capital R cosine t, comma capital R sine t, where t ranges from 0 to 2 pi. In that parametrization, the direction of the parametrization is counterclockwise. And if the parameter values t are restricted from 0 to pi, this parametrization will parametrize only the upper semicircle. And if, for example, t ranges from pi over 2 to pi, this parametrization will parametrize a quarter of the circle from the point 1, from the point capital R on the y-axis to the point minus R on the x-axis. And if you look at what happens when t is restricted to values between 0 and 4 pi, now, as t ranges from 0 to 2 pi, you complete a full turn around the circle. And as t goes from 2 pi to 4 pi, the parametrization will turn around the circle a second time. So when t is between 0 and 4 pi, this parametrization will traverse the circle in the counterclockwise direction twice. Now, if we consider a shifted circle, by this I mean a circle whose center is not the origin but the point AB, and if the radius is capital R again, the equation of such a circle will be x minus a squared plus y minus b squared is equal to capital R squared. And a parametrization can be given as xy is equal to a plus capital R cosine t, comma b plus capital R times sine t as t ranges from 0 to 2 pi. And in a similar way to parametrizing circles, we can also parametrize ellipses as follows. An ellipse given by the equation x squared over a squared plus y squared over b squared equals 1 can be parametrized by xy equals r of t equals a cosine t, comma b sine t, where t goes from 0 to 2 pi. Why does that parametrize the ellipse? Actually, if x is a cosine t and y is b sine t, Then when you substitute those in the equation x squared over a squared plus y squared over b squared, after cancellations, this will give you cosine squared t plus sine squared t, which is 1. So you obtain that if xy is given by that parameterization, then it satisfies the equation of the ellipse. So all points in the image of that parameterization are on that ellipse. And as t takes values from 0 to 2 pi, you can get all points on that ellipse by that parameterization. And in a similar way, if we shift the ellipse so that its center is not the origin but the point c comma d, then its equation will be x minus c squared over a squared plus y minus d squared over b squared equals 1. And the corresponding parameterization will be given by xy equals c plus a cosine t comma d plus b sine t, where t is changing from 0 to 2 pi again. Up to now, these were parameterizing certain curves in two dimensions. Now, no matter whether we are in two or three dimensions, if you want to parameterize a line or a ray or a line segment, this is what we can do. Now, consider two points A and B in either R2 or in R3. Now we can consider the line passing through these two points, or we can consider the ray from one of those points, let's say A, towards B, which is the part of the line through AB, which starts at A and which goes in one direction, such that it also passes through the point B. And we can also consider the line segment between A and B. It's the part of the line through AB, which lies between the two points A and B. Now, first of all, from vector equation of a line, we know that by considering the vector v as the vector from A to B, a vector equation of the line L through AB is parameterized as r of t equals the vector A plus t times the vector v, as t takes all values in real numbers. Now, if you want to consider the ray from A through B, then we should restrict the t values to non-negative values. T is greater than or equal to 0, because in that parameterization, r of t equals the vector A plus t times v, where v is the vector from A to B. When t is 0, we are at the point A. When t is 1, we get r of 1 is a plus t times the vector ab. We arrive at the point B. So r of 1 will be the point B. This tells us that if we take positive values of t, then we'll be moving in the direction of the vector v starting at the point A. That's why for all non-negative values of t, this parameterization will give all points on the ray starting at A, going in the direction of the vector AB on that line. And in order to parameterize the line segment between A and B, we need to restrict the values of t to the interval from 0 to 1. When t is 0, that parameterization gives us the point A. When t is 1, the parameterization gives us the point B. And when t is between 0 and 1, we get all points between A and B on that line. That's why it gives us the parameterization of the line segment when t is between 0 and 1. Now, if we have a parameterization of any curve C, either in two or three dimensions, if this is a smooth parameterization, we know that we get a direction on that curve. If we want to parameterize the same curve so that we change the direction on it, if you want to reverse the direction of a parameterization, this is what we can do. Now, let's say that r of t equals x of t, y of t, z of t is a parameterization of a curve such that t takes values between a and b. The second parameterization of that curve c, r2 of t, can be given as r of minus t, where minus b is less than or equal to t, less than or equal to minus a. In other words, r2 of t is given by x of minus t, comma y of minus t, comma z of minus t, such that t is between minus b and minus a. Note that when t is minus a, r2 of minus a will be r of a, which is the terminal point of c, which is the initial point of c, sorry. And when t is minus b, r2 of minus b will be r of b, which is the terminal point of c. So the parameterization r2 starts at r of b and it ends at r of a. And for any t between minus b and minus a, minus t is between a and b. So r2 of t, which is r of minus t, will give you one of the points on the curve c, because it will be given as r of t for some t between a and b. And when we reverse the direction on a curve c, we can denote the new curve minus c. It's actually the same curve, but the direction given by that new parameterization is the opposite direction. So in short, to reverse the direction, you replace t by minus t and restrict the values of t to the interval from minus b to minus a. And we can have a curve defined as the intersection of two surfaces in three dimensions, in R3. And if you want to parameterize the intersection of two surfaces, let's see what we can do on some examples. In the first example, we want to parameterize the curve C, which is the intersection of the two surfaces given by the equations x plus 2y plus 3z equals 6, which is just a plane. And the second surface is given by the equation x squared plus y minus 1 squared equals 1. Actually, in that second equation, there is no z variable. And in that case, we understand that we have a cylinder whose base curve is the curve in xy plane given by this equation. But x squared plus y minus 1 squared equals 1 describes a circle whose center is 0, 1 and whose radius is 1. Now, before trying to parameterize that intersection curve, let's sketch the two surfaces and try to understand what the curve C will look like. So we have the cylinder with base curve, a circle on the xy plane, and which extends in the direction of z-axis as shown in the figure. And we have the other surface as the plane. And when we intersect such a cylinder with a plane, we expect to get a curve C whose shape will look like an ellipse. Actually, it will be an ellipse on that plane. But the question here is, how do we parameterize that intersection curve? Now, to make the solution easier, we can consider the projection of that curve C to xy plane. Since the curve C lies on the cylinder, the projection of that curve to the xy plane will be the circle given by the equation x squared plus y minus 1 squared equals 1. For a point xyz on the curve C, its projection to xy plane, which is the point x, y, will satisfy this equation. Hence, it will be on that circle C2 given by x squared plus y minus 1 squared equals 1. And now we know how to parameterize a circle in two dimensions. And for that circle C2, its parameterization is simply given by x, y equals cosine t, 1 plus sine t as t takes values from 0 to 2 pi. Now for a point x, y, z on C, its projection x, y is on C2, and that projection x, y can be written in the form x is cosine t and y is 1 plus sine t, where t is between 0 and 2 pi from the parameterization of C2. Now we want to also express z in terms of the parameter t. Using the equation of the plane, x plus 2y plus 3z equals 6. Since xyz on the curve C will also satisfy this equation, we get that z must be equal to 6 minus x minus 2y divided by 3. And we have expressed x and y in terms of t using the parameterization of C2. Substituting x is cosine t and y is 1 plus sine t, we obtain that z is equal to 4 minus cosine squared t minus 2 sine squared t over 3. As a result, we get the parameterization of C as xyz equals cosine t, comma 1 plus sine t, comma 4 minus cosine t minus 2 sine t over 3. And here, the parameter t takes values from 0 to 2 pi. Now, another example where we parameterize the curve of intersection of two surfaces is the following. Now, we are given two paraboloids given by the equations z is x squared plus 2y squared and z is 6 minus x squared minus y squared. When we sketch these two paraboloids, we can roughly sketch the intersection curve as indicated in the figure as the curve C. Now, sketching these surfaces and trying to visualize the intersection curve will help us to understand the geometry of the curve. And to parameterize this curve, again, the idea will be first projecting it to one of the coordinate planes. We can project to xy plane or yz plane or xz plane, which means that we eliminate one of the variables from the given two equations to get a relation between only two of the variables, x, y, or z. For example, if we eliminate z from the given two equations, since z is x squared plus 2y squared and z is also equal to 6 minus x squared minus y squared, we know that x squared plus 2y squared will be equal to 6 minus x squared minus y squared, and after simplifications, it gives us the equation x squared over 3 plus y squared over 2 equals 1, which is the equation of an ellipse in the xy plane. And now, looking at the diagram or the figure we have sketched, we can understand that the projection of the curve C down to xy plane will actually be all of that ellipse. So if xyz is a point on that curve C, since xyz is a point on that intersection curve, will satisfy both of the equations, and from the two equations we get the equation x squared over 3 plus y squared over 2 equals 1, the projection of C to xy plane will be that ellipse. And by using the parameterization of the given ellipse as x is square root of 3 times cosine t and y is square root of 2 times sine t, we can now express the z coordinate in terms of t by using one of the given two equations. If we use the equation z is x squared plus 2y squared and substitute x is root 3 times cosine t and y is root 2 times sine t there, we obtain that z is 3 cosine squared t plus 4 sine squared t, which actually equals 3 plus sine squared t. As a result, we parameterize the curve C as xyz equals root 3 times cosine t, comma root 2 times sine t, comma 3 plus sine squared t as t ranges from 0 to 2 pi. To summarize what we did to parameterize that intersection curve, first we roughly sketched the graph of the two surfaces to understand the geometry underlying behind the two surfaces and the intersection curve. And from that figure, we observed that when we project it down to xy plane, It should be a closed curve there, and using the equations and eliminating the z-coordinate, you obtain the relation between x and y as the equation x squared over 3 plus y squared over 2 equals 1, which is an ellipse. And from the geometry of the given surfaces and the curve, we understand that the projection is all of that ellipse. So we parameterize x and y on that projected curve, and then using the expressions of x and y in terms of t, and using the given equations, we can also express z in terms of that parameter t. As a result, we obtained the parameterization of the curve c. Now, we should be a bit careful here. As I said, we projected it to xy plane, and by observing the geometry, we have seen that the projection is all of that ellipse obtained as the graph of the equation after eliminating z. But if we had eliminated x from the two equations, which are z is x squared plus 2y squared and z is 6 minus x squared minus y squared, when you add up the two equations, you can obtain z as z is equal to 3 plus y squared over 2, which is a parabola in the yz plane. But actually, when you look at the sketched diagram, when you try to project the curve c to yz plane, it cannot be all of that parabola. Actually, the projection of the curve c to yz plane will be part of the parabola given by the equation z is
3 plus y squared over 2, but not all of that curve.